little bit out of line here and open a public hearing on House Bill 3476. I see we have Representative Merkley here.
Not another Merkley bill.
Yeah, bring up whomever you want. Except the Department of Energy. Nobody from the Department of Energy. Oh.
I'm going to miss that. I ordered the club media.
Mike, would you tell us what the bill does there?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us House Bill 3476, which exempts energy-saving performance contracts from competitive bid requirements of public contracting law. It directs the Attorney General to adopt models and rules of procedure for entering into energy-saving performance contracts.
Thank you. And we have Representative Merkley, and we have Mike Graney from the Office of Energy, and we have Larry Homburg from Abacus Engineered Systems. Did you do our budget by any chance? Never mind. Okay. Please proceed.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Jeff Merkley from East Portland, and I'll keep my testimony very brief. This issue about public contracting for energy savings performance contracts boils down to the fact that if you take into consideration the value of energy savings, traditional low-cost bidding doesn't capture that value and therefore doesn't work effectively in that area. This area of contracting is a wonderful way to develop a wise long-term strategy and a relationship with a firm that has the capability to execute that strategy, and so I recommend it to the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? That's the shortest speech I've ever heard Merkley give.
Yeah.
No flowery speech or anything?
Next victim?
No sunset.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, Director of the Oregon Office of Energy, and I will also be brief. Just want to say that both we and Department of Administrative Services support this bill. We do think it will result in both energy and dollar savings to the state. There is still a process of competitive bids when Department of Administrative Services goes out, but it gives them the flexibility to pick a contractor that guarantees energy savings and not necessarily the lowest bid. We think it's a good bill and encourage you to pass the bill.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Larry Hamburg. I'm with Abacus Engineered Systems. Obviously, we support the bill, and what I included was just some short success stories from the state of Washington and their program. And the ones I would like to key on are just two real short things, and I will keep it short. Since 1986, on the second page of there, that the state of Washington has saved over $36 million in their for their state facilities. Secondly, is on the third page, is an excellent analysis put out by the state of Washington, where it shows the comparison between the conventional procurement measures, which are design, bid, build, and low bid versus energy savings performance contracts. And the difference is measurably on the side of performance contracting. We find that it would be an excellent way for the state of Oregon to really bring their buildings up to energy efficiency and compliance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, colleagues?
It's just, Mr. Chair, I'm astounded. $36 million is a lot of money.
Close public hearing. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, that is what he said. Was it not, sir?
Yes.
$36 million? Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3476. Mm-hmm. Open a work session on House Bill 3476.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
Move House Bill 3476 to the floor of the Senate. Due pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 3476 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Ms. Gravel, we call the roll.
Senator Spahn.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis.
Aye.
Chair Corcoran.
Aye. House Bill 3476 goes to the floor with a due pass. Is there any competition still going on that I need to be... Or are you still?
I've lost.
You've lost. Okay. Well, good. Let's just put it on Senator Walker's workload then. Senator Walker O'Connor. All right.
Perfect.
Now we have Representative Crummell. We have. Did I see Representative Zahner here too? We have Representative Zahner. You guys ought to wrestle to see who comes up first. Come on up first, Mr. Crummell. Representative Crummell. We will open a public hearing on. House Bill 2148A. We have Representative Kremel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jerry Kremel, State Representative, House District 26. House Bill 2148 comes to you from the House with a 44-13 vote from the floor. It moved from the House General Government Committee on a do pass recommendation unanimously. In developing this bill, we worked with the Department of Administrative Services and Legislative Fiscal, as well as the Governor's Office, to put together the language that you see as a budget reform bill. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and you should have received a section-by-section analysis, and so I'll forego going through every section for you. And I would just request, Mr. Chair, that you take it to a work session and move the bill to Ways and Means with or without recommendation, depending on the committee's preference.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
What does the bill do?
Pardon me?
What does this do?
This is a budget reform bill, Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis. This is a budget reform bill that would moves us from the current service level budgeting model into a performance level budgeting model, which is pretty much what the co-chairs of Ways and Means have been doing with the process in Ways and Means this year. As you know, the Oregon Progress Board has worked with every state agency to develop performance measures that the agencies will meet, and then performance measures were developed by the agencies with the assistance of the Oregon Progress Board and are being looked at very carefully in the Ways and Means process. This bill would also ask the governor, tells the governor in terms of having a 5% reserve, and also requires the governor to indicate any additional funding that might be needed for various agencies and programs. I talked about the performance measures, and then requires the legislature, when we put together the budget, to utilize performance measures for measuring how the agencies are meeting their mission. And that's pretty much it. Directs Joint Ways and Means to determine through the Ways and Means process whether an agency should be reduced, reorganized, or eliminated based on performance and based on their mission and whether it's the core mission of the government. So it's a good government bill. It's not it's not anything that should be looked at as attacking employees or the government itself. But it's a way for us to be able to manage the resources that we have, and hopefully within existing resources.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I guess it does beg a question, Representative Kremel. In your talking points, it says directs Joint Ways and Means Committee examining agency budgets to evaluate whether to reduce, reorganize, or eliminate, and examine whether a private entity could or should perform the agency's activities. What if the Joint Ways and Means Committee decides that adult correction should go to a private entity?
If that were the case, that Joint Ways and Means made that kind of recommendation, then they would need to produce a bill that would take that kind of action. I think it would require quite a bit of debate as to whether or not that's a good move or not. And I know that there are using the adult corrections model, there are some states around the country that have gone to a privatized model. Some of them don't like it and are going back to running it, having the state run it. And I don't think this bill is not trying to suggest that that everything in state government should be privatized, because I don't agree that it should be.
Are you familiar with Oregon's experience with privatized prisons?
I am from the standpoint, Mr. Chair, I am from the standpoint that that we were renting some beds outside of the state that were run by private entities, and I know that the state did encounter some difficulties there, and I believe those contracts have been terminated, if I'm not mistaken.
That was when the sex offenders escaped in the Texas pen, and the Texas pen didn't even inform the Department of Corrections in Texas till the next day. That one?
I don't recall which state it is that we have actually terminated the contract with. I was thinking it was in Arizona, but I am happy to stand corrected.
Probably could have happened there, too. Thank you very much. Okay. Any other questions? Mary Botkin, David Williams, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We actually worked with the committee, or tried to work with the committee a little bit in the House, to try and find some ways that we could amend the bill to do some things that made some sense for us. We were not included in the meetings with DAS, and so we have not signed off on the bill as it's in its amended form. We still think that there are things that could be done to make agencies more responsive to the needs of the legislature and the citizens. And one of the things that could be done to streamline agencies, and I think, Mr. Chair, you know this from your other day job as well as I do, and that is that they could include frontline workers in the budgeting process in a meaningful manner. If you want to know where waste is, go ask the people who do the work. If you want to know what's being duplicated, go ask the folks who don't carry coffee cups around all day. You know, if you want to talk about ways to save money in agencies, you got to talk to people who work in the agencies. And that doesn't happen, and this bill doesn't get us there. You know, we've heard from, I was trying to think, either three or four administrations about the need to involve employees in the budgeting process. Well, the definition of involving employees in the budgeting process is they get to come down here to Ways and Means, try to save their jobs, try to justify their positions, or miss a hearing. I mean, nobody includes them. Their agencies don't include them in any meaningful manner. And to be really honest, it's a frustrating experience, as you know, to try and include them in this process, even though people, you know, it's not an indictment on the legislature as much as it is just that the process is very hard. It either moves very slow or very fast, and folks get pretty frustrated. I think that the bill requires that agencies justify their existence from beginning to end, and it doesn't really establish any criteria for how we decide what core services are. And, you know, it's been my experience that folks really don't want to do the hard work. They'd like to build roads, but they don't want to scoop the snow. And, you know, our folks do both. I mean, they repair the roads and they take care of snow removal. And, you know, our experience has been that they don't want to do the latter half of some of the jobs we do. And, you know, we're willing to continue to work with folks to find a better way to make agencies more responsive to the legislative process. We're all frustrated with the way, you know, with the way the budgeting process works, and we're willing to continue to work to try and find better ways to do it.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That you're here for the bill, too.
I'm here for House Bill 2148 and Gross. OSCA, for the record, David Williams with the Oregon School Employees Association, representing 20,000 classified and certified school employees in Oregon's K-12 and community college districts. We're opposed to House Bill 2148, two main tenets of the bill. We are increasingly concerned with the inflexibility we're building into our budgeting process. And I think that a lot of this is highlighted by the downgrading of Oregon's credit rating. And if you look at the comments made by all the major credit bureaus, they point to the inflexibility that we already have through things like Oregon's kicker law as reasons why our credit rating has has been downgraded. And we are also concerned with Section 12 of the bill and specifically the privatization language in there. A lot of what our members do is vital services that if you were to create a business plan for it and try to get funding, no one would fund it. They're public services because they're services that need to be performed and need to be done, but are not things that you want to do for profit. And I know you have a long agenda, so with that, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, I'm not sure how, I mean, I have concerns about the privatization aspect, too, but I'm not sure how this bill builds inflexibility. I mean, it just looks like you have to start saving your money, holding 5% back and making agencies give 50% of their money back if they have done good things and keep the other half. I mean, where's the inflexibility
right.
in that?
Well, I think, and Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, thank you. The inflexibility is in requiring a budget to have an unobligated ending fund reserve. While there is sound budgeting policy about maintaining a reserve, and we certainly advocate a reserve, certain times dictate certain amounts of reserve. For instance, in our current budget situation, we may not be able to meet a 5% reserve because there are other needs in the budget that trump having an empty pot of money being held over. And so I think that it behooves the legislature to have that kind of flexibility, that kind of open-endedness in its budgeting process to be able to say, you know, this session we, you know, can only leave behind a 1% or 2% in ending fund balance, not 5% or more.
But don't you think we would not be in the trouble we're in today if we did a little bit more savings? Like, Americans don't save more than beans. I mean, ask anyone in this room what their savings account looks like, or just the average working person out there, and it's pretty bad. So if you force yourself into saving some, don't you think that builds more assurance that you have money to work with?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I definitely agree that had we been putting away money in the good years, we certainly would have an easier time now. And perhaps that begs the question of some sort of general fund reserve or rainy day fund, which we could have been putting the kicker money into instead of sending it back in the form of kicker checks and saving that over the last decade of exponential growth.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Mess.
Well, I was going to say, Senator Walker, I think you're right, because even if this became law, all you have to do is have a provision that says notwithstanding ORS 291-200-13, the following is blah, blah, blah. We did that with a kicker before it became constitutional, so I don't think it ties your hands at all.
I'll grant you that point, Senator Madison.
Thank you very much. Close public hearing on House Bill 2148 and open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3136. No, I have no intention of sending it to Ways and Means. Mr. David Mark Ellsworth, whatever your name is, tell these nice people what this bill does.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us House Bill 3136. This measure stipulates that boxing matches between persons who are not professional boxers and who are not receiving any financial compensation are not subject to the licensing and bonding provisions of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission.
Thank you. Okay, tough guy. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Give it your best shot.
And committee members, for the record, Representative Zahner, District 22, North Salem and Woodburn. This bill was cleared through our General Government Committee in the House, and then it cleared the floor by a 55-3 margin. And basically, you saw a similar bill this session that removed wrestling from the control of the State Boxing Commission. Since then, we've had our first of many WWE wrestling events held just a couple of weeks ago in the Rose Garden. I checked with the legislative fiscal and the Rose Garden, They don't know exactly how much money the state of Oregon received at the moment, but I can tell you that when the WWE was in Seattle about a month ago, it was the single biggest event ever held at Safeco Field. State of Washington took in $144,000 in tax revenue that night, and also that evening, or the afternoon, and that evening they were in the Seattle Dome. They picked up another $49,000, and the next day in Spokane, $26,000 in tax revenue. We need that to happen to Oregon. The bill does basically the same thing, a non-professional sport we want to take out of the Boxing Commission. At this very moment, there are promoters waiting to bring into Oregon amateur boxing events. Those events will bring in much-needed monies to our state. That's basically it. You'll hear proponents say that people die from tough guy boxing, but it's actually the safest ring sport. And people die skiing. I have friends who have lost their lives in skiing on bicycles. My son-in-law's sister dropped dead at the University of Oregon during a basketball camp. So people take risks, and that's just part of life. Tough guy boxing is well regulated. It's not a professional sport. Should not fall under the same guidelines. I'm open to questions. Thank you, committee members.
If it's not a... what benefit do the winners of the competition get?
Well, they're the tough guys then. I mean, it's a macho thing, you know, like coming out instead of fighting at the Donald Tavern, like you and I did when we grew up. We can go in the ring and do it, and that's it.
I wouldn't fight with guys like you. I'd hit them with boards.
But
there's no economic benefit to the winners of this?
No, there's just prestige.
I see.
They bring their friends, and that's it.
And speaking of tough guys, Senator Menace?
Like the old smokers used to be in high school.
I used to be tough, and then I got old. I was going to say, Tony and I could be like a tag team or something for Munchkin Wrestling.
That's right. You just want to put us in that place, don't you, Senator? This hearing was going along beautifully. No short jokes or anything, and then up you come.
Make a good straight man, don't I?
Yes.
Actually, I think I want to make clear that the state would benefit by a tax on the gate, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
This doesn't do anything to take away from the gate receipts that they would ordinarily receive.
No, no. Right?
So there is some potential income. I just want to say that the Judiciary Committee heard earlier a bill introduced that the Department of State Police wanted to recodify a prohibition on no-holds-barred boxing or fighting, kick fighting, et cetera, and because they apparently found a loophole around it, and they're now doing it. And one of the questions the committee asked was whether or not it's in fact as dangerous as it was originally purported to be in 1997 when we thought we'd made it against the law. And the answer was, we have no idea. We have no incidents. For 18 months they've been doing this around the state of Oregon. There's not one single injury, and not one person has been injured as a result of this. So the question we asked them was, well, you want to prohibit this, why? So I think Representative Zahner is right that for the most part these things are reasonably well managed, and they do provide a benefit to the state in terms of the gate receipts and bringing promotions to the state of Oregon. But I think there are medical professionals that are generally available in that sense.
And Mr. Chair and Senator, they use 16-ounce gloves. They all have headgear, big belts on, and the rounds only last a minute, but actually they only last about 30 seconds. You swing a little, you're out of wind, and somebody goes down on one knee and it's over with. Stop. I mean, we saw the last one they had in Salem. They had 26 fights in the ring, and we had two up where we were drinking beer, and that's where the best fights were up there. But, I mean, nobody gets hurt, and it's just a macho thing. And girls do it also. Tough girl.
So if I remember correctly, you're pretty good with your hands, Representative Zahner.
Oh, man.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else to testify on this bill?
The bill should pass.
Senator Menace moves House Bill 3136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, you know,
Senator Walker?
Saw an article in the paper this weekend about this great big giant wooden roller coaster they built in Seattle that's bringing in lots of money. I'd much prefer to be doing that than boxing people around.
Do you want to amend the bill?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I love roller coasters.
Might as well. I'm looking at that every bill I get. No, I'm okay with it. Just, you know, I see other economic development. I'm not into watching guys or ladies beat their brains out. But, you know, I guess people like to do it. So. There you go. You got my vote.
Mr. Chair.
One other follow-up for the record. The Chinook Winds will bring one in about a month, so you'll have one at Chinook Winds. It's all set to go. And so they'll start promoting, and we'll start getting revenue, and then they'll have some in Salem when the new theater's built. So.
Yeah, so originally this bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, was to abolish or have the commission abolish itself or come up with a plan to abolish itself. Like this session, we're exempting, if we're going to exempt this tough man, we're exempting professional, quote-unquote, professional wrestling. What is the need for a boxing and wrestling commission in this state?
Well, unless they become promoters, I don't really see a need for them. I think it's about $89,000 a year, the cost. And I think if they got matchmakers together and started bringing in some fights, there'd be a need. But they only had the Jones fight one time, and they just need to promote. And that's not been their business, so they need to be thinking in the promotion mode.
Thanks.
Mr. Senator, anything else? Ms. Gravel, we call the roll, please.
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. And House Bill 3136A goes to the floor with a due pass. And let's see, who wants to carry this?
I think Senator.
Mr. Chair, didn't the wrestling bill come from Representative Tootie Smith, who's his seatmate? And now we
don't usually let representatives carry bills over in the Senate. I'll carry it. Okay. You want to carry it?
We can tag team it.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, committee.
The munchkin and the leprechaun will tag team.
30 seconds and then they fall over.
We'll close that particular work session. We're going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 790. Would you tell us what that does, Mark, please?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, the version of the measure which we're hearing now is substantially different than that which was originally presented to and drafted. As amended, the measure prescribes the manner in which race dates are allocated for various classes of paramutual racing as determined by the Oregon Racing Commission. It allows for an overlap of race dates of the Multnomah Greyhound Park and Portland Meadows as ordered by the Racing Commission.
Okay, we have Dave Nelson, Portland Meadows, John McCauley from the County Fair Association, and Dave Benson from Oregon HBPA. What is that?
Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Associations. Mr. Chairman, we represent all the thoroughbred owners and trainers racing in the state of Oregon.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing Magna Entertainment Corporation, who owns the franchise to operate both Portland Meadows racetrack and the Multnomah Greyhound Park racetrack out at in Senator Minnis' district. What the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 790 are the gut and stuff amendments that completely wipe out or eliminate the language that was in Senate Bill 790 and replace it with a language that simply eliminates the old prohibition on the two racetracks overlapping themselves. The purpose of that is to allow Portland Meadows Racetrack to work with the horsemen's associations and with the dog owners to potentially pick up the race meet that was lost at the Oregon State Fairgrounds when they amended their operation or changed their operation about 4 years ago. They did run a 25-day race meet during the fair and during the month of September, and that was lost to horsemen when the state fair got out of the horse racing business. So what this language does is allow us to move forward, work with the horsemen's associations to try to regain that race meet for more employment for the horsemen, more entertainment for the fans. We worked with all of the parties involved in it. Everyone is supporting the bill. I worked particularly with the County Fairs Association to protect their interests during their summer fair time race meets. And you'll find that language on page 4, which gives them control over their own race meets as they ran during the calendar year 2002. So we would urge your support.
And you're pushing the Dash 3 amendments?
The Dash 4 amendments.
Dash 4 amendments, okay. Go ahead, gentlemen. Any questions? Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Fairs Association. Our interest in this bill was to make sure that the small nonprofit race meets that run during the summer were not adversely affected should commercial race days overlap with those meets in like Burns, Tillamook, Grants Pass, etc. There are only about five of those nonprofit race meets in the entire state. We're satisfied with the provisions that were added to the bill. Page 3 of the bill, starting lines 14 through 22, those address the issues that we had concerns with to make sure that there wouldn't be a conflict with the commercial race meets overlapping the nonprofit summer race meets. And with that, we're satisfied with the bill, Mr. Chair.
Racing is almost always nonprofit for me. One question, Mr. Nelson, does Senate Bill 70 or 790 with the new amendments impact any of the hub revenues or fees?
No, Mr. Chairman, it does not.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Any questions of Mr. McCulley? No.
Mr. Chairman, Dave Benson, president of the Oregon HBPA. As we said, we represent excess of 1,800 horsemen, owners and trainers in the state of Oregon. And as Dave Nelson mentioned earlier, Oregon State Fair ceased having horse racing approximately 4 years ago, which created an undue hardship on many of the owners and trainers who relied on that income for to provide a living for their families. It's been very tough, and this bill, as amended, hopefully in the future, could an additional meet could be added that would help the horsemen. We would support the bill.
Okay. We're in a work session in order to move the amendment into the bill, and then we're going to close the work session. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Minnis.
Move the dash 4 amendment, Senate Bill 790.
Senator Minnis moves the dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 790. Any discussion?
Just one question. Mr. Ben.
Senator Minnis.
Do you have any relatives that were cops?
I'm sorry?
Any relatives that were cops?
No, but they're very good friends.
You look like one of them.
You're talking, well, they're Roy Benson, the same name as my father.
All right.
And they used to live on. I'm sorry. Out of,
we don't need to butter him up. He's going to butter
Burnside. They lived on 62nd.
So I worked with your dad. Okay.
And I knew Bob Benson's a very good friend. His son, still to this day.
Very good. Tell him hi for me.
I'll do that.
Were you both involved in the gunfight at O.K. Corral?
Before I was too young.
I see. Okay. Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please, before we get in trouble.
Senator Scott.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Is adopting the dash 4? Yes.
Yes.
Vice Chairman.
Aye.
Chair Parker.
Aye. So the dash 4s are adopted, and we'll close the work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 790, and we will... For those, I'll just remake this announcement again. We are not going to do House Bill 3020 today. We're still awaiting amendments. With that, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 494. Tell us what that does, Mark. Refresh our memory. We haven't heard this for a while.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have again before us Senate Bill 494. We have discussed it on two previous occasions. As before us, it has been substantially changed and amended. The intent of the measure is to prohibit public employers who receive state funds from using state monies to assist, promote, or deter union organizing.
Okay, thank you very much. Why don't we have Lynn Marie Kreider up first, and she can explain the amendments. And then also, after you're done, Ms. Kreider, I'm going to have... he's not on here. Is he still here? Miller? Sean Miller? Oh, yeah, he's here. Okay. Sean has some questions. So I think after Ms. Kreider presents her modifications, I'll have you come up, Sean, and you two can have a dialogue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. I think you have before you the dash 6 amendments to the bill. The purpose of the bill is to conserve state resources and keep the state neutral with respect to union organizing. The changes that you see basically are several to limit the scope of applicability of the measure and further to streamline its operation. Basically, those entities which would now be covered would be public employers, recipients of state grants, and contractors for services, not for goods, and only covering those contractors who receive 50% or more of their income from the state, from state funds. The only prohibition that the bill as amended would have is the prohibition of use of state funds. The old sections 3 and 6 are gone. And with regard to the administration, there is no longer an obligation to maintain a set of books for the purposes of this bill. And monitoring of compliance would be done by the contracting or grantor agency rather than by the Attorney General having audit authority. The Attorney General still would be the one to bring suit to enforce the mandate of the bill, and taxpayers could bring suit, but if they were to bring suit in bad faith, they could have attorney's fees for the other side assessed against them. So there's that deterrent to bad faith lawsuits.
Thank
you. Can I answer any questions?
Any questions, Ms. Carter?
Not yet.
Okay. Sean, why don't you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Question on the bill and just a concern. I understand the intent of why the bill was introduced, but it does appear, and it is of concern, that the contractor and of a private employer could, because it does not reference the services, could apply to public improvement contracts, such as a contractor who contracts with the state to build a DAS project or a highway project. And I guess the question, Mr. Chairman, from us was is the intent to apply to public improvement contractors? I know that the Dash 6 amendments that address at least 50% of the employer's business income, from the contractor's standpoint, even though a private employer, in 1 year you could have had a huge job, a state job, that could maybe tip the scale 50% of the income for that private employer in the year, and was wondering if there's an effort to organize that company and they're a non-union company, hiring a lawyer, let's say, in that instance, would that be prohibited under the particular bill in expense, and how you calculate that? These are just questions that were arised when we saw the amendments, and understanding the intent of the bill, there is no reference to Chapter 279, the public contracting, when you're defining services in the bill, and that's some of the we just want that clarified so we understand the intent of the bill and if that is actually part of the bill, because again, in wages and public improvement, we're treated quite differently. We're under prevailing wage laws under these state projects that are administered by BOLI, and so it's a little bit different standard, I think, than maybe some of the intent that they were trying to get after, and that's just a question of the committee, Mr. Chair.
Want to take a whack at it?
Mr. Carter? Chair, members of the committee, it would be my understanding that it would include public service or public improvement contracts. It does cover, there's no question that it covers private employers when over 50% of their business is with the public.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr?
Would that have to be a single 50%, so a let's say it's a road construction company, and they have a large job, say, in Washington County, but it's not over 50% of their total revenue, and then they have another job with ODOT that it's not over 50% of their revenue, and then they have another job with Clackamas County, but it's not over 50% of the revenue. Would this bill then apply to them or no?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think it is in the aggregate. That is, it refers back to the prior year, the year before the contract is entered into. You look back to the prior year to see whether their business has been for the prior year, when you can actually see what their income was, whether that was predominantly state business or not. But it would total all of the contracts that they were receiving income.
Mr. Chair,
But just yes, but just for clarification, Senator, it's use of state funds. So if Clackamas County, Washington County funds, those count too? I was just trying to get that straight in my mind.
No, it includes, it's only the state funds that go through that public contract. So if it were a combination, you would look at how much was the state funds.
Okay. Senator Stark, so it would only be, it's not all public funds, just state funds.
Yeah, I mean, county roads money, I wouldn't think applies, but it's not a test.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from a construction standpoint, we're treated differently, whether it's a county job for building a school or building a state highway. We're all under Chapter 279, the public contracting law. And so we're treated the same as whether, you know, paying the prevailing wage. And so this is a different standard just on a state job, which... Again, I didn't realize it was the intent of the drafters to include public improvement, but I guess it is, and we have concern with that.
Senator Metz,
could you help me understand, Lynn Marie Critter, how would this function now with all of the amendments? How would someone find themselves having to produce records or being scrutinized in the process?
Well, for a contractor, Senator Minnis, first of all, when the public entity entered into the contract, they would have to look at and discuss whether or not this applied. If it did, the language of the contract would require compliance with this, so there would be notice in that sense. And then the contracting agency, the agency that actually entered into the contract with the contractor, would be the one that had the right to monitor compliance.
Okay, so you have a review of, I guess, the contractor's, what, current status as to whether or not this applies?
I would assume that would be part of the contract writing process.
In
yes, Senator.
In the contract, a contract says, thou shalt not use any public funds for the purpose of prohibiting blah, 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 union organized, et cetera, correct?
Correct.
All right, and then... So they sign a contract, they go about their business, what happens?
If either in the ordinary process of auditing contract compliance, that would be one of the things that the public contracting entity might look at when they send in an auditor to look at that contract. Right. Or if there were some reason that the agency had some reason to believe there was a violation.
So there's one auditing, or two, there's a justification, there's a complaint filed of some sort, right, based on, I assume, a set of facts.
I would assume so, Senator Minnis.
Well, yes. Trying to figure it out. And so an audit or a complaint, right? Just a general audit. And aren't these contracts...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that's right, yes.
Aren't these contracts already audited?
In most cases, I believe that is the case. So this would simply be added to an audit checklist that the agency would be using.
All right. Okay.
Did you get your questions answered?
Yeah.
Okay. Ms. Botkin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing AFSCME. And I just was going to point out that, you know, this isn't... as long as Sean's... clients don't run an anti-union campaign, there's not a problem. This is about union neutrality.
Right. But
you know, so...
If they were accused of running an anti-union campaign, I guess that's what somebody says, hey, I think the contractor XYZ is doing anti... That's what I'm interested in, what happens. You have a complaint, but what's the basis of the complaint? Is it just I think this is happening, or there have to be a factual circumstance articulated that would rise to the level then that there's an investigation? Or I understand the audit thing, that would just happen, something that they're looking for compliance. So I'm a little concerned about the complaint-driven side.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I think it's a little difficult. Clearly that employer has a right to run an anti-union campaign, just not to use state money. So it's going to be difficult for there to be a credible complaint made. Okay. For an entity that only receives 50% of their funds. If they receive 90% right. of their funds, it's going to be easier to say, well, there's really a reason to go in and do an audit outside of the general audit process.
Yeah, all I'm getting to, Mr. Chairman, is just that if there was a complaint, that there would have to be some set of facts stated that would give some basis to believe that, in fact, they are in violation, as opposed to, I think they are, and therefore you launch an investigation. I don't know if I'm making any sense or not, but I mean, even
Would the Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it makes sense to me that the agency would say, we're not going to go in and do a special check on this unless you give us some reason to believe that there's a problem here.
That's what I'm looking for.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, Jessica Harris, AGC.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. For the record, I represent both union and open shop employers, and we have some concerns about this bill and its applicability to public improvement contracts. From a highway contractor perspective, nearly all contracts involve ODOT funds. Further, they are the bread and butter of our industry, so this would apply even if they're doing a local contract in nearly all instances to highway construction. It's our concern that we don't understand the extent to which an anti-union campaign is construed, whether it's a comment in a meeting for which the company has provided refreshments and therefore is an expenditure of potentially these funds, or whether it's a broader issue than that. We're concerned that from a contractor perspective, we don't necessarily keep track of which funds are used for what. So if you have received monies from the year before and you use those funds, you don't necessarily know which funds you're using for what. That's, I think, a very difficult thing for us to keep track of. The record-keeping portion of it would be significant. And in terms of knowing if you're ending one calendar year, one fiscal year, and you're starting another, whether or not your percentage of revenues, because those are calculated on different bases, whether it would apply or not apply, I think is also a confusing piece as you start to enter into contracts the next year. Our other concern is this does apply broader than just the public improvement sector. It would apply because services aren't defined to just a wide variety of things that are contracted for. So we just have a lot of questions about on the ground perspective, how does this work and what is the deterrence or the promotion piece of it, what does that exactly mean?
Thank you, Ms. Harrison. Questions?
Just one,
Senator Starr.
Just to kind of follow up on your basically all these projects use state funds, I guess one question I would have is the highway fund, all of those funds are collected at the state level and then they're shared down to the local level. So would those funds, even though it might be a local contract, the genesis of them have come from the state highway fund and that it's a pass-through money to local governments. So would that be construed as state resources even though it's a county or a city that's letting the contract? Even because the source of those funds is the state highway fund. State gas tax dollars that are allocated to cities and counties.
I think we could bring Ms. Crowder up to answer that. Thank you, Jessica.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Marie Kreider again. The definition of state funds includes monies appropriated by the state and transferred to a public body, and then the contract is let by the local public jurisdiction. So, yes, it would include money that was pass-through money in that sense.
So, Mr. Chair, this bill would apply to virtually every construction road construction contractor in the state.
Doing state business. Thank you. We're in work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
I move the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 494.
Senator Minnis moves the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 494. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'm going to oppose the amendments. I'm going to oppose the bill. I think that as you look at the public contracting, public improvements, businesses in this state, they're under a lot of already regulation about how they, who they pay or how much they pay. The public contracting statutes are well established. I'm not sure that we need to unnecessarily open up these private employers to this additional level of government regulation. I think that this legislature ought to be looking at rolling back regulations on private employers, not adding to them, especially in light of our current economic environment.
So noted. Yes, Senator Miss.
I just want to say I actually appreciate Ryder's work on the bill, because I've been kind of a thorn in their side in scrutinizing this bill. But I think that the committee ought not lose focus on what the central objective is here, and that is to make those persons who rely on state dollars or state funds and agencies to be neutral as it relates to both supporting and or opposing labor organizations. So it's a neutrality issue. It's on both sides. So I think given the work that's been done, and notwithstanding comments that I'm at least sympathetic with made by Senator Starr, I think that this bill, as it's currently formed, would kind of serve as a good notice that you ought not engage in activities that are either for or against the union. It is what it is, and you focus on the job or the task at hand. You build a bridge, or you build a road, or you build a building, or you do your function. If it's street sweeping or cleaning or whatever it might be, that's what you focus on. You focus on the job and not whether or not somebody's pro-union or anti-union. And basically, if they're doing that, then woe is unto them. They need to take into account what's occurring there. So I'm going to support it, and I appreciate the fact that the unions have brought this forward, and you know, I don't see any evil that is inherent in supporting the bill.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Minnis is right on about that. I was reviewing my notes when we heard this on April 2nd, and I remember how shocked I was about the kinds of activities that took place on the job, and I was really glad to see this bill come back. And I know that we had questions about commingling of funds and that sort of thing, and I think that the proponents have done a good job of trying to address those issues. And I just have to balance the, maybe it's a little bit more regulation with, yeah, but what we've been doing is really bad and inappropriate. So somewhere you've got to find a balance. And I think we can do that with this bill. And I'm very supportive.
So noted. Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Olson.
Dash six amendments. We are amending in right now.
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair
Portman? Aye. Senate Bill 494 has been amended with dash sixes. Senator Minnis?
Chair, move Senate Bill 494 is amended as before the Senate to pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves Senate Bill 494 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, Ms. Gravel, you call the roll?
Senator Starr?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Corcoran? Aye. Senate Bill 494-6, with the dash six amendments, will go to the floor, and I'll carry it. Put my name on it. Thank you very much. I want to very quickly open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 50 for the purposes of moving it down to Ways and Means. Would you tell us what Senate Bill 50 does, please, Mark?
The Senate Bill 50 has been in committee, and it modifies the calculation of current service levels for funding of counties that provide correctional services.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Move Senate Bill 50 to Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Minnis moves Senate Bill 50 down to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
No recommendation.
I take it. Any discussion? Hearing none. Ms. Gravel, call the roll.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Corcoran? Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 50 is on its way to Ways and Means. We'll close that public hearing and work session. We have 2167, 2246, and 3120. Why don't we do the two housing ones next? We'll open a public hearing work session on House Bill 2167, please. Should let us know what that does, Mr. Elster.
Senator Corcoran, we have 2167A, which removes the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service from the purview of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. It directs the commission to investigate the feasibility of having duties performed by a nonprofit tax-exempt organization and report its findings and recommendations for legislation to the governor by January 31, 2005. Okay. It's my understanding we have an amendment.
Dash two amendments.
The CA2s?
Yes, sir.
A dash two amendment.
Okay. We have Jack Kenny and Oscar Sweeten Lopez, and I take it this is a friendly divorce.
Senator Corcoran, that is correct.
Okay.
And I will, again, for the record, my name is Jack Kenny. I have written testimony that's being distributed now, but I'll, in the interest of time, kind of skip through it. Basically, you characterized the issue quite well. This is actually a good bill from the purposes of governmental efficiency standpoint, we believe. We've been working with the commission and its staff. Oscar Sweeten Lopez is the chair of the commission and has worked. We've worked together to find a satisfactory resolution of this. The dash two amendments essentially address some issues that were raised by the legislative fiscal office. Section 4 creates a mechanism to move unexpended appropriation from the housing budget into the commission's budget. Section 5 protect the commission and its business partners, saying that any obligations, rights that were in effect at the time of the separation remain in effect. Section 6 essentially does the same thing relative to administrative rules, stating that the administrative rules of the commission that were developed as a part of the housing department remain in effect as they become an independent entity. And Section 7 delays the implementation of the independence of the commission until July 1, 2004, and that will provide time to continue to work through transition issues, and the commission supports those.
Does this have a Ways and Means referral on it?
Chair Corcoran, it did initially have a Ways and Means referral, so I believe that would be appropriate.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Oscar Sweeten Lopez, and I am the chair of the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. I've been involved with the commission for over 4 years. I was an AmeriCorps member and began as a youth representative and have continued to be involved with the commission. Given that time frame that I've been involved, we've explored several different national options in terms of structures that commissions such as this that administer these AmeriCorps funds take. Working very closely with Mr. Kenny and the Department of Housing and Community Services, as a commission, we have wanted to move forward in exploring some of these other structures, as stated in the bill, to explore 501c3 status. And so I'm here today just in support of the House bill and the amendments.
Thank you very much. Any questions, colleagues? Hearing none. Senator Menace, we're in work session.
We are in work session. I'll move the A2 amendments to House Bill 2167.
Senator Menace moves the A2 amendments to House Bill 2167. Any discussion? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
Move House Bill 2167 as amended before the Senate. Committee on Ways and Means.
Two Ways and Means. Okay, with the due pass recommendation. Senator Menace moves House Bill 2167 as amended to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Ms. Gravel, we call the roll, please.
Senator Farr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Chair
Brooklyn? Aye. 2167 as amended to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now we have a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2246. So let us know what that does, please, Mr. Ellsworth.
Senator Corcoran, we have before us a measure which allows the Department of Housing and Community Services to charge fees for providing persons with intellectual property acquired or developed by the department. It allows a housing authority to charge fees providing persons with intellectual property developed also by the housing authority, and it appropriates monies from said fees to the Department of Housing Authority, respectively.
We have Bill Carpenter and Phil Donovan. Phil, you want to come up, too? Go ahead, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Carpenter. I'm the administrator of the Information Services Division of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2246. This bill allows us to be reimbursed for the cost of developing certain software applications and collecting specialized data sets. Currently, we're authorized to provide partners and stakeholders with this information, and we can charge governments for that information, but that is not our practice. In order to clarify this, we've worked with Senator Minnis to amend this bill to remove federal, state, and local governments from the bill so that there's no question about charging them for these services. The amendment and bill will allow us to continue to develop and provide necessary tools for our partners, such as the Oregon Housing Model, that will help them make more informed policy decisions and better address the housing and community service needs within their services areas. The bill has a small fiscal impact. We estimate about $10,000 in the next biennium, and we ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Donovan?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. And put simply, House Bill 2246, as amended, would provide housing authorities with the same tools as Oregon Housing and Community Services to recover costs associated with developing intellectual property. A real-world example recently from the Washington County Housing Authority is they developed a program that helps them estimate the development, operation, and cash flow for new acquisition projects and new construction projects, and in an effort, you know, to bring about better government. And if it's good for a local housing authority, it may be good to a private developer. And private developers have expressed an interest in some of these this intellectual property that's been developed. And this legislation would allow us to recoup those costs and reinvest that into more technology and help us more effectively provide affordable housing. Can support the amendments. Funny story was that over on the House side, we were asked the question of, under this legislation, would you charge local governments? And we said no. And we came over to the Senate side, same question was posed to us, and we were told to get it in black and white. And that's what the -A2 amendment does. So we could support that. We would urge the adoption of the amendment and passage of the legislation. Thank you.
Questions? We're in work session.
Move the A2 amendment to House Bill 2246.
Senator Minnis moves the A2 amendments to House Bill 2246. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Minnis.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2246 is amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2246 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, we call the roll.
Senator
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair
Corcoran? Aye. Okay, House Bill 2246 submitted to the floor, and Senator Minnis will carry it. Thank you very much. We're ripping right through these, colleagues. Very good work. We have one more public hearing and work session on House Bill 3120. Would you let us know what this good government bill does, please?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 3120. We have heard previously and moved two amendments on May 21st into the bill, the -A3s and the -A4s. We have now before us two amendments, one that contains the body of a Senate bill, heard this session, Senate Bill 893. Which allows occupational licensing agencies to deny or revoke licenses if they have been convicted of criminal activity, and a second one which removes confidentiality obstacles to the state government central business registry.
Okay, thank you. And we have -5s and -6s, I take it? Okay.
Yes.
Why don't we start with Mr. Allen, Office of Regulatory Streamlining? Ms. Buchanan, welcome. It's nice to see you in a different context in the Revenue Committee.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Speaking to the Dash 6 amendments briefly, a central business registry is nothing fancier than a way around the issue that businesses face today where they register with the Department of Revenue, the Employment Department, and they have to go down the mall a couple of blocks to register with the Corporations Division, file yet different paperwork with the Workers' Compensation Division, providing substantially all the same information to all those agencies. And then as time goes by, things like phone numbers, business names, business addresses change. They again have to go to all those different agencies to make those changes. There have been a number of barriers to creating a central business registry, a one-stop way of dealing with all that information. One of them has been the fact that certain information, if received by the Department of Revenue or the Employment Department, although not what most people would consider sensitive, like business name, address, phone number, is considered confidential and is information that those agencies are not authorized to share, to the point that employees who do so can be subject to a ban from ever working in state government again. What the Dash 6 amendments do, beginning on page 7 and with language that repeats itself on page 12, do is carve out an exemption to that confidentiality that allows the Revenue Department and the Employment Department to share a defined list of information: business name, address, phone number, the form of the business, is it a corporation, sole proprietorship, and so on, a business registration number, with other state agencies. And to the extent that those agencies, as the Corporations Division does, posts those records to the Internet, allows that information to be able to be made public, so long as the source of the information is not made available. We've been working this for a while. I've had conversations directly with NFIB and with AOI, and they, both of whom have told me that they are that the concept of a central registry and this information being able to be shared is not something that they object to. We've worked with the Employment Department and Revenue, and Deborah Buchanan is here from Revenue to talk about their issues.
Senator Streamline Menace.
Well, you know, it's funny. The problem with being in this building a long time is I thought we did this like 13 years ago. Seriously, Delna Jones carried a massive bill on the floor that was supposedly a centralizing of all of this information.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, I agree. I've actually, in different jobs I've had, been kicking around the edges of this issue for about that long. There have been, over time, two different sets of barriers, one being just a systems barrier. Until fairly recently, you had to go actually create a computer system to do this, and someone would have to buy it and pay for it and build it and those kinds of things. Electronic data interchange allows computers to talk to each other much more easily, so you don't have to do that. That's a barrier that's gone away. We've effectively consolidated some kinds of reporting. The Employment Department and Revenue now have consolidated reporting for all the employee withholding kinds of information, but not the basic business registration kinds of information.
I'm glad to see we're at least within 10, 12 years of the private sector on a lot of this stuff. So good. We're getting better.
Ms. Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I simply wanted to point out that this would be what we would view as a significant policy shift for us. The legislature has set the policy of tax information remaining confidential when it's filed with us, even to the extent of whether or not a person has filed a return. So we just wanted to make you aware of that. We appreciate Mr. Allen working with us and putting in language there that disclosure would be subject to an interagency agreement, and just explain that our intent, at least initially, would be to consider a business taxpayer to be corporations and employers that are subject to withholding at the very beginning. So we would probably not be disclosing a business that files a Schedule C as a sole proprietor, presuming that they're not subject to any other registration requirements with the state that could disclose the fact that they have filed a tax return. So our first step would be to work with the corporations and the employers subject to withholding laws.
Deborah, it says on page 12 of the 13A that it describes the business taxpayer's name, address, telephone number, state-generated common identification number. Is that consistent with the statement you just made that certain sole proprietors wouldn't fall into this, or are they granted a state-generated common identification number?
Mr. Chair, a sole proprietor would not necessarily have an identification number issued, although I believe the reference here is that there would be a new number issued for the businesses that are registered here, and perhaps Mr. Allen wants to speak to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding of the existing business identification number is it's a number that's generated for employers. And so it's not the kind of thing that would capture sole proprietorships, partnerships, who that's the only business form they have is as a sole proprietorship who have no employees.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, folks, very much.
Thank you.
Christine Shute from DOJ. Welcome. And you're here on the dash fives, I understand.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Christine Shute, Oregon Department of Justice. Yes, I'm here in the dash five amendments. The Senate has already considered identical language in Senate Bill 893. That bill passed the floor with no contra votes. A couple people were missing that day, but no one voted against the bill. The bill clarifies the ability of state licensing boards and commissions to consider conduct that did not occur directly in the course of the licensed activity in making disciplinary decisions. This is in response to two Oregon appellate court cases that you may or may not remember, Dearborn versus Real Estate Agency and Curley versus Real Estate Agency. In those two cases, the Oregon appellate courts read the authority of licensing boards very, very narrowly and essentially said that if misconduct doesn't take place directly in the course of the license activity, that the licensing board cannot consider it. And this would open that up so that the licensing boards could consider conduct not directly in the course of the licensed activity. And I have examples galore if the committee's interested, but you may simply remember the bill from before.
Any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. All right. Anybody in the room have any problems with the dash fives or the dash sixes?
We're good to go.
Just a question.
Yes.
The original 893, did that bill come out of your judiciary committee?
No, actually, it came out of Rules Committee originally. I actually had it drafted with the Department of Administrative Services, but because Rules drafted it, it stayed there, if I'm not mistaken.
In response, the bill is sitting over in the House Business and Labor Committee right now, and it's been on my list to have moved along with several other bills, and it's been stuck in limbo, so this is a way to get it moving. And I appreciate
it. Darn Representative Menace.
I know nothing.
I know nothing. Colonel Glink, I know nothing. Okay. Senator Menace moves the dash five amendments to House Bill 3120. Any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered. Any objection? Sorry, so ordered. Senator Menace moves the dash sixes into House Bill 3120. Any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Senator Menace moves House Bill 3120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
You're doing a good and focused job.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Todd.
Aye.
Senator
Baldwin.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Corcoran. Yes. Aye. Thank you. So ordered, Senator Menace. You had a piece of this. Did you want a piece of this?
You betcha.
Okay, Senator Menace. Garrett, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.